Andrew Bacevich is a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army. He received his Ph.D. in American diplomatic history from Princeton. Before joining the faculty of BU in 1998, he taught at West Point and at Johns Hopkins University. His newest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. As a veteran who served in Vietnam, Bacevich brings the full weight of his expertise to the subject, connecting the dots of a sweeping narrative from episodes as varied as the Beirut bombing of 1983, the Mogadishu firefight of 1993, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and the rise of ISIS in the present decade. Again, the name of the book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and we welcome Andrew Bacevich to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
What led you to want to look at this military history, especially during this time?
Well, I think my sense that there is too little recognition of the fact that we have been engaged in a very expansive military enterprise in the Islamic world for well over three decades now, with no end in sight. So although there is always some amount of tension to the immediate events, for example, right now the Syrian civil war and ISIS, I was just struck by the fact that there's little appreciation for the historical context in which present-day events are evolving. So this is an effort to get readers to take stock of our military efforts in the region going back several decades.
So let us start with this discussion point, which is from the end of World War II until 1980, virtually no American soldiers were killed in action while serving in the greater Middle East. Since 1990, virtually no American soldiers have been killed in action anywhere else. What can we take from that statistic?
Well, what that indicates is that during the 1980s, a profound shift in U.S. strategic priorities occurred. Prior to 1980, there were really two parts of the world that we were willing to fight for. One was Western Europe, the other was East Asia. By the time we get to the end of 1990, the Cold War now having ended, one region of the world now captures the greater amount of attention. But beyond that, I think the other thing is that during the Cold War, notwithstanding the shooting wars that occurred in Korea and Vietnam, by and large, U.S. military policy was premised on the notion of containment, of posturing military power to prevent hostilities. In the war for the greater Middle East, there's been little attention to containment. Rather, the policy has been informed by the notion that the active use of American military power can bring about positive change. And that, alas, has not been the outcome that we've achieved.
You are very specific in calling it the war for the greater Middle East. Define that for us.
Well, we're talking about a great swath of the Islamic world, not the entire Islamic world. When Jimmy Carter touched this thing off by announcing the Carter Doctrine in 1980, his focus of attention was specifically on the Persian Gulf. But when you think about where U.S. forces have been active in the Islamic world since 1980, clearly the region goes far beyond the Persian Gulf itself. It's included North Africa, it's included Lebanon, the Balkans, Afghanistan and Pakistan. More recently, U.S. forces becoming quite active in Western Africa, in countries where there is perceived to be an Islamic threat. So it began as a war for oil focused on the Persian Gulf. It rather quickly morphed into something encompassing a much broader geographic area, and quite frankly, including ambitions that look well beyond oil.
When you talk about the Carter Doctrine, and let us begin with President Carter, Because I believe you use early on in the book, use the word ramshackle to talk about the structure that had begun to collapse. What were the fundamental mistakes that were started during that time, in your opinion, that led us down this path?
Well, we inherited a mess. I cite Jimmy Carter for initiating this war for the greater Middle East, but certainly he did not create the problems that led to that war. And it's a complex story. It's a big story. It's a story of European imperialists in the immediate wake of World War I who sliced and diced the Middle East to suit their own purposes. It's a story of chronic economic underdevelopment of local leaders who were corrupt and unenlightened. It's a story of religious conflict within Islam. It's a story of the creation of Israel. All of these together created this dysfunctional situation, which Jimmy Carter chose to plunge into militarily when he enunciated the Carter Doctrine.
And you do talk about this as a war of choice. And as it went on decade after decade, was it always a choice, or once we were in it, and it was entirely impossible for us to extricate ourselves from it?
You know, my view would be this. We are the most powerful country in the world, and power provides choice. So I believe strongly that there have been choices all along the way. The choices we have made from one administration to the next, this is involves Republicans and Democrats, the choices we have made reflect an unwillingness or even a refusal to recognize how military efforts up to that point have failed to yield the intended outcomes. There has been this tendency on the part of one administration after the next to think that trying a little bit harder or employing a different tactical methods will somehow or other yield the expected outcome of greater stability or greater democracy or a reduced antipathy directed at the United States. But those expectations have never been fulfilled.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and it is quite fascinating, of exactly how do we define a U.S. victory? Is it possible to define that?
Well, I think the appropriate definition, we should always be mindful of that famous dictum of Clausewitz, that war is the continuation of politics by other means. So victory ought to be defined in political sense of having achieved essential political objectives in a conclusive fashion. So there have been battles, engagements, that the United States has won in a military sense. Operation Desert Storm back in 1991 would be a good example. The initial invasion of Iraq in 2003 would be an example of an operational success. But what we haven't done is achieved that conclusive political outcome. And in that sense, victory has proven to be very elusive.
Do you believe that over the past several decades that we have come even close to knowing what a proper long-term strategy could be?
No, I think that this has been an abiding flaw. Administrations have not done a good job of thinking strategically. They have reacted to problems. You know, whether it's unrest in Lebanon, or whether it's a terrorist activity initiated by Muammar Gaddafi, or whether it's a humanitarian crisis in Somalia. Policy responds to a particular problem. There has rarely been a larger context to explain how addressing that particular problem is going to lead to, more broadly, a positive outcome. So the absence of strategy to guide this war has been a continuing problem.
You also fault military recruitment, the system that we have for military recruitment.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of Vietnam, when the draft collapsed, President Nixon created what we call the all-volunteer force, meaning that we embraced a professional military. There are all kinds of positive things you can say about having a professional military, but there, too, there was a great unintended consequence, and the unintended consequence was to allow a gap to develop between the American people and their military. Now, we camouflaged that gap with our support the troops rhetoric and gestures along that line. But the fact of the matter is that we have not paid much substantive attention to how the troops are actually being used. And as a consequence of that, we have subjected them to abuse by allowing them to be committed into unnecessary wars, mismanaged wars. I think genuine support for the troops would express itself as a great popular determination to refuse to allow our troops to be sent into harm's way except when absolutely necessary, but that's not been the case during our war for the greater Middle East.
When you look at the issues that you address in the book and the last four decades and what has gone wrong, and in some instances what has gone right, or at least sort of right, what do you see for those of us who are currently getting ready to head to the polls, if we haven't already, in our primary in the fall election then?
Well, I mean, I think what we should be saying to the candidates is this. Don't tell me what you're going to do about ISIS. I understand you're going to destroy ISIS if you're elected president. Tell me what you make of our military experience in the Islamic world over the last 3.5 decades. Give me your judgment about where this war is headed and when it will end and on what terms it will end. In other words, we should demand of those who aspire to be the next commander-in-chief that they be able to articulate an argument that reflects a strategic vision. And I must say, up to this point, none of them have done so, but frankly, none of them have been pressed to express a strategic vision.
Do you see any, and I certainly understand what you're saying, I guess when you say pressed, what are the questions that we then need to ask? I mean, you outlined just a moment ago, but is there a main point, do you think, that is being missed, not only within the context of campaign 2016, but in our foreign policy discussions in general?
I think the main point is that, and this is not, again, to be laid at the feet of one particular party or at the feet of the military itself, but over the past several decades, we have come to have an unrealistic expectation of what military power can do. And those unrealistic expectations have then contributed to the misuse of military power, quite specifically in the greater Middle East. I think there is an urgent need to have a serious conversation about what military power can do, where it should be employed, and where things it can't do, and where alternative methods need to be employed.
You talk about in the book about an issue that I think is really interesting, because there have been no accounts, there have been no demands for accountability. There have been no serious protests of late, especially mirroring or looking, comparing to what we had in the 1960s prior to and during the Vietnam War. There is no real anti-war movement as of now.
Right.
And as a result of that, there has been no substantive discussion,
right,
even as we enter the election process. So what does that say about us, and what do you think the effect would be of such a movement?
Well, I think what it says about us is that politically we engage only where where we feel affected by the issue. You know, when you think about the considerable number of Americans who participated in the Occupy movement back during the Great Recession, or the people who have participated in the Black Lives Matter movement related to perceived police abuse, people take to the streets. They get angry. They actively participate in the political process because they see themselves as having something at stake. I think the problem with the war for the greater Middle East is we don't think. We, the general public, don't think we have anything at stake. Few of us have any direct involvement with the military, and even the government has not even required us to pay for the wars undertaken in our name. Rather, the responsibility to make those payments is being sloughed off onto future generations. So the fact that we are seemingly unaffected, I think, has contributed to that the problem that you cited.
You said a moment ago that no candidate has come forward with what you believe to be the right recipe for tackling this problem, although also saying that they have not been pressed to do so. With that said, I do want to focus on Donald Trump, because he has been the most outspoken when it comes to the plans as far as quickly and decisively bombing the hell out of ISIS, rebuilding our military, and make it so strong that no one, and I mean no one, will mess with us. Should we be scared about such rhetoric?
Well, I think so. I mean, I frankly, I think that Senator Cruz's rhetoric on these same matters is just as reckless, and both of them display the sort of the historical amnesia of not really thinking seriously about what prior U.S. military power has achieved there. And I would hasten to add, I'm not persuaded that Secretary Clinton herself is all that much better, because she too is reflexively hawkish, and I think lacks that willingness to think critically about past policy, perhaps above all in issues where she's been personally involved, as, for example, the 2011 Libya intervention, which reduced that country to anarchy.
So do we just keep going down the same path that we're going down?
Well, that is our inclination. Sadly, it would appear to be that's going to continue to be our inclination, unless we can somehow find a way to incorporate into the political debate the reality of what our efforts over the past several decades have actually achieved. But the aperture is so narrow that the larger context simply doesn't come into play.
So I want to ask two questions as we wrap up. One is, because we've been talking about a lot of the negatives, have you seen any positive things that give you a sign that if we did more of this, we would be in a much better position?
Well, I'm not sure I can give you the more of this part, but I've been out of the Army longer than I was in the Army, so it's not like I have my sort of finger on the pulse of the officer corps.
No, but in general,
but from
foreign policy.
But from time to time, I hear from officers, active duty officers, people I don't really know, who basically have read something that I've written and say, you're right, we need to hear more of this. And my point there is not to pat myself on the back, but to suggest that within the officer corps itself, I believe that there is a growing capacity to think critically about our wars and what they have yielded. Now, I would like to see that same capacity also begin to appear in our civilian political leadership, because that's what's going to be required. There's going to have to be a change in the mindset that prevails in Washington when it comes to military power. And so I think there's some inkling of that kind of change. I would not say that I think that it has reached a point where it's anything like decisive.
So with that said, the final question then is, are you at all optimistic? And if so, where does that optimism lie?
Well, no, I tend not to be optimistic. I think at root, I retain hope that the American people will sort of awake from their slumber, that they will come to see that their obligation to the troops should entail something more than simply, you know, applauding in pregame ceremonies, and that therefore our democracy can come alive. Not a heck of a lot of evidence that that's going to happen anytime soon, but I'm not going to relinquish that hope.
And, of course, this does come, the goal here, obviously, would be peace, correct?
Well, I mean, broadly speaking, I think more concretely, the goal ought to be to restore a semblance of stability to a region that is in chaos, and the goal ought to be to therefore begin to reduce the costs that we are sustaining, fiscal costs, human costs, the sacrifices of our soldiers, to reduce those costs and be able to attend to matters of far greater moment than trying to police the Islamic world.
Andrew Basevich is the author of the new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. It is published by Random House. Andrew Basevich, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me on your program.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, published by Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.